All right,
okay.
This conference is being recorded. I would invite everybody, if you know you have some background noise, to please mute yourselves either on your own phone device or with a star 6. If I have to do a master mute, Rabbi Tal, for your own understanding, please note that you might have to do a star 6 to unmute yourself, okay?
Okay.
Rabbi
Shaker. Right now, though?
You're
maybe
good.
Do a master mute.
It's cool. Right now, in fact, I will. I'll do that. I'll do another master mute. Hold on.
Okay.
All right, so for the time being, if you callers would please leave yourself muted except right Rabbi Taub. Rabbi Taub, would you unmute yourself, please?
Okay. Can I be heard?
Okay, we got you. Yeah, you are being heard. Rabbi Taub is one of our beloved guest speakers, author of one of my favorite books, God of Our Understanding, Jewish Spirituality and Recovery from Addiction. Rabbi Taub speaks to us about many topics. He's and speaks worldwide about addictions and is expert in this field and has what to share. So without any further ado, Rabbi Taub.
Thank you, Dr. Chaim. It's an honor and privilege, a great thrill for me. Let's just get right down to business, why I'm here. I understand that recently the group finished reading The Doctor's Opinion, which is part of the front matter of the big book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And The Doctor's Opinion speaks about the disease of alcoholism, how it works, and why it's such a problem. Often, I think that although in SA, especially in this group, where you guys are real big book thumpers, and I say that with the greatest respect because I aspire to be a thumper of the big book myself, but nevertheless, with all the respect for the big book, I think sometimes the doctor's opinion is overlooked because it seems to have so much to do with alcohol, and how does that parallel or translate into sexaholism. So what I want to do is I want to speak about the clarity, the absolute clarity that is given to us in the doctor's opinion so that we can understand the nature of this disease, we can understand what its components are, and how eventually, with God's help, it can be overcome. Now, before I begin, I just want to make one disclaimer, which is that nothing I'm saying right now is going to get anybody sober. Why? Because I'm going to give you information. Information is clarity. And information, knowledge, and clarity doesn't get anyone sober. Okay? Making ourselves open for God power gets us sober, and the steps are a way of getting ourselves open. So you're going to have to work the steps or do something else to open yourself up to God either way. Nevertheless, the purpose of getting some clarity is to give the proper motivation and encouragement that you'll actually want to do the steps. But if you're an Ishpashit, a simple thinker, and you don't need to be complicated with all these things, and you're ready to throw yourself wholeheartedly into step work without understanding what the disease is and what recovery means, then you don't need this call, and you're golden. Stay how you are. Don't complicate it. But if you're looking for some clarity, here it is. The doctor's opinion, which was written by Dr. Silkworth, who was a physician who attended to Bill Wilson, the co-author of the big book, while he was in Towns Hospital in Brooklyn, explains alcoholism as a twofold punch. There are two components that have to occur at the same time, or it's not alcoholism. And those are the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. If a person has the allergy of the body and not the obsession of the mind, or he has the obsession of the mind and not the allergy of the body, he's not an alcoholic. What would be an example? Let's speak in cases. Jewish people traditionally understand concepts by talking about cases. If you've ever learned Gemara, you understand how that is true. So let's talk about a case. Hypothetical case number one, here's a fellow who the last time he was at the Kiddush, and someone said L'chaim with him, he ended up passed out in his own vomit that Shabbos afternoon, and he doesn't even understand why. He never intended to get drunk. He realizes, after this happens a couple of times, he has a funny reaction to alcohol. He doesn't just take a shot and move on. That when he gets started, he doesn't really know how it's going to end. He's got what we call an allergy of the body. He has some allergies are your throat swells up. Other allergies are you break out in hives. This allergy is that normal people get a little alcohol, they get a little buzz, and it feels good. He gets a little up on his body, tells him you've got to pound more and more of this stuff into your system until you pass out. So he realizes this about himself, and he says, I'm allergic to this stuff, or whatever word he uses. It's not important what language he uses. The point is he says, I don't handle this stuff very well. I'm not going to do this anymore. Just like the guy who realizes that when he eats kiwis, he gets rash on his tongue, and he never eats kiwis again. So he says, when I start drinking, I don't know how it's going to end up. I don't react well to this stuff again, and it's not a big struggle, and it's not something he thinks about very often. It's just a fact of life. And his story is resolved. That is a fellow with an allergy of the body. Clearly has an abnormal reaction to alcohol, but he has no obsession of the mind. The fact that he can't drink doesn't really bother him. It's just like, I can't eat kiwis. No? All right. So you don't eat them. That's just scenario number two. Scenario number two is he's the guy who shows up at work, and from 9 in the morning, he's rallying the troops. He's going around from cubicle to cubicle and telling everyone, we're going out drinking after work. And there's no way that we're not going to go. We've got to go drink, and it's going to be awesome. And then 5 o'clock comes, and he's got everyone out the door, and he goes to the bar, and he orders his beer and his shot, and he gets them poured down his gullet. And he says, wow, that really hit the spot. That was awesome. And he goes home. Well, that guy has an obsession. He was thinking about it all day. That was his primary thought all day. When am I going to get out of here, and I'm going to go get my drink? But he doesn't have an allergy of the body. He was able to take a drink. He was able to feel the effect. And he was able to stop at that point. So his problem might be a little bit worse than the first guy because it's more persistent, but it's not really going to ruin his life. He gets obsessed about drinking, takes a drink, and he's satisfied. So neither of those guys are alcoholics.
Okay, Rabbi Taub, excuse me just a minute. Apparently there's been other check-ins that are creating a background interference. So let me do another round of muting. Okay, hold on.
Okay.
All right. The call is muted for the time being. Heva,
okay.
Please note that if you have any background noise, it's probably too high right now to stay muted, certainly until we get around a question. So if you're coming on board, please mute yourself with the star 6. All right.
All right.
Go ahead, Rabbi Taub.
Great. So let's talk about scenario number 3. Scenario number 3 is a guy who, just like scenario 1, when he starts drinking, he really doesn't know how it's going to end. He gets one shot into him, and he very well may black out. He's not really sure what happens. He has that component. He also, though, has, like scenario number 2, the obsession with drinking. Well, he's really in a bind because there's something that he can't safely do. He can't safely consume any amount of alcohol. And yet, his great obsession in life is that he can handle it. He's the one who's beyond human aid. He is the one who's the candidate for recovery. Because he can't just decide to stop. Understand, his double bind is, once he starts, he doesn't know how far it's going to go because of his allergy of the body. And yet, he can't just accept that fact. He's obsessed with the fact that he can start and stop it at will, how he wants, when he wants. That's the obsession of the mind. So it's the 1-2 combination. It's the combination of both. If you have one without the other without the one, he would not be an alcoholic. Okay. That, I think, is not that complicated. But it is something that's greatly overlooked. so it's important to state it. Now let's translate this to the terms of sexaholism. What is the allergy of the body? What is the obsession of the mind? Let's start with the allergy of the body. The allergy of the body is activated by the first drink. In other words, if the alcoholic would never take the first drink, he would never activate the allergy of the body. Now, what does the allergy of the body activate? The doctor's opinion calls it the phenomenon of craving. In other words, an alcoholic cannot, by definition of the doctor's opinion, if we're going to use those terms, cannot experience a phenomenon of craving unless he takes the first drink. He will not experience the phenomenon of craving unless he takes the first drink. So don't take the first drink. Oh, well, if I only had an allergy of the body, I would. But I'm obsessed with being able to handle the first drink. And so then I take the first drink, I activate the phenomenon of craving, and all bets are off. Okay, so in sexaholism, what is the first drink? This is where there's a great lack of clarity. People try to understand what's it going to be like after a person goes through all 12 steps and has a spiritual awakening and they become a recovered addict. The goal of the steps is the obsession should be lifted, and that's permanent freedom. So people say, well, what is that going to be like? What, will I be a tzaddik? I'll have no yetzahara. I won't notice things. I won't react to things. And then the whole question is, well, what about when I need to have those feelings in the confines of marriage? I mean, what's going to happen to me if I'm really recovered? So we have to make it very clear what the first drink is. The first drink is lust. Lust is a behavior, albeit a behavior that usually is done in one's own mind. But it is not the automatic reflexive reaction. In other words, normal yetzer hara, if we can call it that, notices things, sees things, thinks that they're interesting. That's normal. Even the recovered sexaholic will notice things and say, hey, that looks interesting. Just like a recovered alcoholic might see a bottle of alcohol and say, hey, that looks interesting. The only difference between the recovered and the unrecovered is that the recovered alcoholic will look at the bottle and say, hey, that looks interesting for a split second, and then the second conscious thought kicks in. He'll say, oh, that's right, I'm allergic to that stuff, I ought not drink it. And he's able to listen to that voice of reason because his obsession has been lifted because of this experience. Now, before recovery, he tells himself, oh, I don't think it's a good idea to drink that, but the obsession kicks in and says, don't worry, it'll be okay this time. Let's translate that to sexaholism. The unrecovered sex addict sees something, he notices it. So far, he's done nothing wrong, by the way, just by noticing it. He becomes conscious of the fact that he wants to start lusting. Lusting is a decision. It's a behavior. Again, albeit a behavior we do often in our own heads, so it becomes a little tricky. We don't think of it as a behavior because it's not a full action, but it's a conscious decision to start lusting, not the reflex reaction. It's the deliberate action that comes a second later. So the unrecovered sex addict says, you know what? I ought not start lusting. When I start, I don't know how it's going to end. And the obsession comes and tells him, don't worry, it'll be okay. You will be able to stop, or it'll be only this one time, or whatever it is. The recovered sex addict, the only difference is he notices it, he sees it, he likes it, all in a split second. The voice of reason kicks in and says, you better not start lusting. And because the obsession is lifted, the voice of reason is the one that wins, and he says, oh, I won't start lusting. So in other words, what is the recovered sex addict's experience? He sees it, he notices it, he reacts to it. But the split second, which is the difference between involuntary and voluntary, that's where his reason kicks in. So in other words, it's very important, I think, for us to understand. The recovered sexaholic is not free from noticing things and having a reflexive reaction to them. He's got the same yetzahara that everyone has. The only difference between before recovery and after is that he's using free choice to not begin the lusting. Now, that's a very important point. Before, when he was an active addict, he also was using free choice. He was just using free choice to make the wrong choice. Powerlessness doesn't mean that a person doesn't have free choice. Powerlessness, because this is a question that all the great, you know, deep theological thinkers are always asking in recovery. What about free choice? You always have free choice. The problem is, though, when you have a ruach shtus, which is the obsession of the mind, it makes you repeatedly make bad choices. Because the obsession is going to convince you, the ruach shtus is there to convince you that this choice will work out okay, and then you choose it. But that is where the battle line is between the involuntary or reflexive reaction, which you have no control over, even after recovery, and then the voluntary, conscious, deliberate decision to begin lusting. I want to clarify this a little bit more. There's a difference between the hardware and the software. The difference between the machinery, your actual brain, the way it works, your seichel, the way it's wired, and the programs that you're running. In other words, we all know the times tables. 3 times 3 is 9, 3 times 4 is 12, 3 times 5 is 15. And we could all think the times tables right now. Were we thinking them 10 minutes ago? We weren't thinking them 10 minutes ago. Did we know them 10 minutes ago? We knew them 10 minutes ago. So there's a difference between what you're thinking and what you know. Your brain can have knowledge of a particular tiger, and not only have knowledge about it, even have an opinion about it. I like that tiger, right? And yet, that is not machshava. That's not thought. That's not deliberate. It's not active. It's not conscious. I do not have a choice about what kind of wiring I have. I don't have a choice what my first gut reaction is to stimulus. What my choice is the next second. Am I going to take this in and play around with this in my own head and bring it into behavior, whether thought or speech or action? That's where my choice is. Even the unrecovered addict has that choice. It's just that the obsession convinces him to make the wrong choice. So, if he wouldn't start lusting in the first place, he would not activate the phenomenon of craving. But the obsession of the mind convinces him that he can safely start lusting or lust like a gentleman without repercussions. And that's where he gets ruined every time. What does recovery do for him is it removes the obsession. When the obsession is removed, then when it's the moment to make the choice, do I start lusting or not start lusting, I've already noticed I've had a reaction in the split second. I feel attracted. Now my question is, actively, consciously, deliberately, do I begin to lust? And if the obsession is removed, I can tell myself, no, I don't start lusting. The starting to lust is the first drink. If I don't take the first drink, I don't activate the phenomenon of craving. So the freedom comes because the removal of the obsession. Now let's ask, this person who's had the obsession removed because he did all 12 steps and had a spiritual awakening, was the allergy of the body removed? Let's talk about the alcoholic who's got 20 years happily sober. The obsession is removed. He doesn't think about alcohol. Not his part of his life. But if he would start drinking just for the heck of it, would he activate the phenomenon of craving? Would his allergy of the body still be there? Yes. In other words, the sex alcoholic could be recovered, which means he's free from the obsession. He notices things, and he's able to remind himself, oh, that's right, don't take the first drink. Don't take the first drink of lust. And yet, if he were to take the first drink of lust, he would activate the phenomenon of craving. He would have that reaction. In other words, I heard one time an old-timer say, like take a whole box of Ex-Lax, you know, diarrhea medication. Actually not medication for diarrhea, it's medication to give you diarrhea, diuretic. Eat a box of Ex-Lax and will yourself not to go to the bathroom. Okay, you did something to your body. By starting to lust, you activated a faulty reaction. So that's where the loss of sobriety comes in. You can't play with this because you can't handle it. But here's the beauty of it. It's not a boogeyman that's going to run up from behind you in a dark alley and grab you. It's not, there's no secret. It's not like it can blindside you and you don't see it coming. The obsession, yes, the obsession is sneaky. The obsession is cunning, baffling, powerful, and for that you need the higher power to remove it. But the phenomenon of craving is very straightforward. It only gets activated when you take the first drink of lust. So when we have that clarity, we understand a few things. One is we understand what we're powerless over. Okay? Powerless doesn't mean we don't have free choice. It means when we're unrecovered, the obsession tells us to make bad choices. Bad choice being, I can handle something that I, from 10,000 examples, I clearly cannot handle. That's one point to know. Second point to know, the recovered person still notices things, still has an automatic reflexive reaction to them, but is able to react sanely to that stimulus and say, oh yeah, I remember, I can't handle this, I better not start lusting. Which, conveniently, by the way, if you're a religious Jew, has to coincide exactly with the responsibility the halakha places upon us. Nowhere in Torah does it say you've done anything wrong for having an automatic reaction and noticing something and even liking it. Because you didn't eat tzeif if you saw a bacon double cheeseburger and said, that looked yummy. When do you cross the line? When you say, I'm going to eat it. Or even, Nebuch, I can't eat it, but I'm going to sit here and choose to fantasize about it. You know, Torah also expects us to control our makshava. Even in the Aseret HaDibros, there's a mitzvah thought related. Vesachmai, don't covet, is a thought-based mitzvah. And the point there is to tell us that thought is behavior. But there's a difference between an initial split-second noticing something and willful thought where you fantasize about the thing. Noticing something does not activate the phenomenon of craving. Fantasizing about it does. In other words, another way to put it is nobody is allergic to the Yetzer Hara. That's not the allergy of the body. They're allergic to giving the Yetzer Hara an outlet in either action, speech, or thought. That's the line according to the halacha. That's the line according to the doctor's opinion. When we know what the line is, we can feel a lot more safe that we're not going to accidentally activate this thing and not even know how it got activated again. Okay, so those are basically the two main points that I wanted to stress, that we should understand where the line is, we should understand the difference between the first drink and noticing the bottle, so to speak, and we should understand what life is like as a recovered person who's had the obsession removed. Okay. Now, because there's a lot of information out here that I've placed out on the table, a lot of terms, a lot of concepts, I want to take questions, but I'm begging you, please, not ask a question that is off the topic. The only type of question that is of service to people on the call is a question directly trying to clarify the terms that I have used so far. The point of me being here is to clarify some terms so that we can have a good working vocabulary of what the dynamics of the disease of addiction are. So please, only questions clarifying the terms that we're discussing here now.
All right. So first of all, Rabbi Taub, I'll try to facilitate the those questions that are coming in. Hevra, you'll want to, or six, to allow yourself to ask a question, and then when it's done, please mute again. And Rabbi Taub's explanation of the terminology so far is very complex, and yet the way you present it in such simple terms, the dynamics between the phenomenon of craving and the obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body, is fabulous. One question that I know that I've seen asked is, well, what do we do until we're able to lift the obsession? What do we do about that obsession so that we can hope to have recovery? So
that
can you address that, please?
That's a great question. Okay, that's a burning question. First of all, let me just correct your words. What do we do until we lift the obsession? We don't lift the obsession. The whole definition of need for a higher power is that God removes the obsession. So, but I know that I know David Chaim well enough to know that that's exactly what he meant. I just wanted to clarify for others. But until the obsession is lifted, is a funny situation. Until the obsession is lifted, basically, I have the phenomenon of craving, evade the allergy, okay? I have the obsession that's telling me I can safely activate the allergy and I won't have consequences. And yet my life is going to hell and I really don't want to start again. So what do? I white knuckle. White knuckling includes, please listen very carefully, white knuckling includes going to meetings, calling people on the phone, praying, all this great stuff that sometimes we consider to be the pinnacle of recovery, is white knuckling. If it's not opening yourself up for a spiritual experience, psychic change, it's white knuckling. If it's not something that will remove the obsession, it's white knuckling. I'm not putting down white knuckling. It has its time and place. The time and place for white knuckling is until the obsession is removed. The timeline for the obsession being removed is however long it takes you to work the steps. So then the real question becomes, what do I do while I'm working the steps? And the answer is, you're white-knuckling until the obsession is removed. White-knuckling is not a bad thing if it's not your life plan. If you're planning on white-knuckling for the rest of your life, it's a terrible thing. You're white-knuckling it while going through the steps to get the obsession removed, then it makes a lot of sense. Somebody told me once, though, I can white-knuckle, let's say, 3 weeks. And from my past history, it seems like it takes me 4 weeks to get through the steps. So what am I supposed to do on that last week where the white knuckling gives out and the obsession still hasn't been lifted? That's the real question. I think the answer to that is simple. The answer to that is try the best you can to white knuckle it. It's not endless. It's not infinite. There is an end to it. When you finish the steps, you'll have a spiritual awakening. You'll have a psychic change. The obsession will be lifted. If you had to white knuckle it forever, I can understand. It becomes unbearable. But there is an end to the obsession. It will come when you have your spiritual awakening. Just try to get to the end of the steps. If white knuckle is painful, then throw yourself that much more into step work so you can quickly get that obsession removed.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, hello?
Hello?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering, if a person worked the 12 steps through alcohol, does he need to rework the 12 steps in order to have a spiritual awakening with the obsession from lust?
That's a great question. I think the answer to that is, look, there's nothing magical about this fellowship, that fellowship. These aren't real distinctions. If a person came into AA and at his bottom-out experience, he admitted powerlessness not only over his drinking, but over everything else, a person could work the steps for various obsessions simultaneously. Question is, do we guide people like that? I think we should. I think when somebody comes in who's beautifully desperate, who is ready to do anything and everything, I think it'd be great to take a look at all the obsessions. Unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, the reality is most people are going to tackle the obsession that seems to be the most But in theory, or actually in practice, I can attest to this, that whatever a person wants to know of in their step work, it can all be removed. I mean, it's not a heavier load for God, put it that way.
Richard in Toronto. Is a spiritual awakening guaranteed to happen? I've been in the program for 10 years, and I've overcome other addictions like marijuana, but my sex addiction seems to be predominant, and I can't seem to... I still have the obsession, and it always seems to come back, and I've been through the steps.
Right.
Isn't the step something, so I guess it's a two-part question, isn't the step something that has to be reworked over and over again? Okay. And also,
I'm of the opinion that if you work the steps properly the first time, then really 10, 11, and 12 are your lifetime maintenance. You're doing 10, 11, 12 daily as lifetime maintenance. But it's not like doing all 12 steps over and over again unless they were done improperly. So to answer your question, there could be two reasons for this. One, why a person would fail when they're in the program for 10 years. One reason is they never properly did the steps. I'm not accusing you of that. I'm just putting it out there as a possibility. A person never properly did the steps. They hung out in meetings for 10 years. They talked a lot of recovery. They spoke to a lot of addicts. They worked some steps here and some steps there. Maybe piecemeal, they've done a little bit of every step, if you put it all together. But they never really properly did the steps. That's a possibility. I'd say in most cases where someone says, I've been in recovery for X amount of years and I'm still not from the obsession, it's because they really didn't work the steps. That's the first possibility. The second possibility is the following. A person who had a spiritual experience and had the obsession removed and was dependent on an alcoholic. He doesn't think about drinking. It's not a big deal to him, even though it used to be the main thing he thought about in his life. Now he doesn't think about it. Yet one day, somebody gives him a drink, and he doesn't know it's a drink. He takes that drink and finishes it and says, did you just give me alcohol? And I say, yeah, we did. Oh, you ruined me. You just ignited my phenomenon of craving. Now, probably what he'll do is, at that point, is lock himself up, so to speak, because he knows he's in for a real doozy of a time. Let's say he took that drink and he didn't even know it. He took that drink and someone gave it to him day after day after day, and finally that phenomenon of craving, it'll do its job. It'll make the person just fly themselves with alcohol. He didn't lose his obsession. I'm sorry. He didn't gain back his obsession. He lost his obsession. What sunk him was not that the obsession came back. The obsession never came back. What sunk him is he reactivated the phenomenon of craving by activating the allergy by taking the drink. What is this akin to in sexaholism? To be someone who went through the steps of a spiritual awakening, he's not obsessed anymore. He reacts sanely to sexually provocative stimulus. Okay, and I'm making the point again. He does recognize sexual provocative stimulus. He reacts sanely to it, and the same reaction is, oh, yeah, I ought not actively harbor this thing. Okay, so be all that stuff, and yet, let's say someone's been slipping him drinks. Or let's say he doesn't realize he's been buying cider in England. He didn't realize in England cider is alcoholic. In America, cider is for kids. He didn't realize. Does the allergy of the body care? Doesn't care. Doesn't differentiate whether it was shaking amazing, whether he knew what he's doing or not. There are people, sexaholics, who not knowing what they're doing are activating the phenomenon of craving. Not that they're losing the spiritual awakening, but they actually unknowingly activate the phenomenon of craving. How do they do it? Well, the obvious thing, like the person says, well, I watched a dirty movie, but I didn't touch myself. Right? Okay. So that's obvious. We say, buddy, you're activating the phenomenon of craving. What are you doing? But there's other things that are less obvious, more subtle. The person who treats his wife disrespectfully in the bedroom. He doesn't realize his lust that he's feeling for his wife is a lust. It's activating this phenomenon of craving. Now you're going to say, well, hold on a second. What am I supposed to do, be a robot? Oh, yeah, to be a robot. You're supposed to feel love. You're supposed to feel respect. You're supposed to feel bonding, intimacy. It's very exciting and passionate. You're not supposed to feel lust. You're not allergic to sex. You can have sexual act. You're allergic to lust. What's lust? Lust is using sex as a way to take, to give to myself, to take. So he's taking from his wife instead of giving to her. He's activating his allergy, and he doesn't even realize he's doing it. How can he know that this is lust? Ask himself a very simple question. When he's with his wife, could this be someone else? If it could be somebody else, then this is not intimacy and bonding in a marital setting. It's lust, but he's doing it in a setting that he thinks is kosher. But his body doesn't know the difference. His body, his allergy of the body doesn't know the difference whether this is his wife or a prostitute, because the way he's feeling towards his wife is like a prostitute. And so he's shocked that he's ignited the phenomenon of craving. So Nebuch, the recovered sexaholic, is going to actually have to be on the bench in the bedroom. Not only is he not supposed to lust out on the street, but he's actually supposed to have healthy, bonding intimacy with his wife, with love, respect, and care and compassion, and should be free of lust. Lust is not the same as the emotion that people feel, bond and intimacy. And if a person thinks that lust is the same emotion as the emotion people feel when they bond in intimacy, that itself is just a sad testament to how deeply a person is in lust. But one should have hope in realizing that there is an intense emotion that's holy and kosher and accompanies bonding and intimacy. It has nothing to do with lust. Not only is it not related to it, it's like the opposite of it. And the recovered sexaholic can have a very healthy and vibrant, intimate life with his wife in marriage. It doesn't activate the phenomenon of craving because it's not lust, it's something totally different. Well, we have a couple minutes here, yeah?
Well, Rabbi Taub?
Yeah.
Hey, this is Larry. Does the type of lust really matter? Whether if someone is obsessed about, let's say, same sex, opposite sex, dominatrix, whatever, does that really matter? The type of
that's,
it? Where
no, that's like saying, does it matter for an alcoholic if I drink rum or if I drink beer or if I drink wine?
Okay, so it really doesn't matter. It's all the same, and it's really, it needs to be treated the same way, whether it's shameful or not shameful or acceptable, socially acceptable, whatever.
Exactly. You can talk about the shame and the social acceptance, and you can talk about that with your therapist. That's great.
Right.
Therapy. It's irrelevant to 12-step work. Thank you for pointing out the distinction.
Thank you.
Rabbi Taub, could you talk a little bit about dopamine in the brain as the allergy of the body?
Say this again, I didn't hear you clearly.
The dopamine in the brain, the chemical reactions which occur when I take in lust, it changes my brain chemistry. Oh, this is Ed from Munson.
Okay, I'm not a neurologist, and I don't understand the actual physical or physiological dynamics of the allergy. I know how it manifests. I don't know the inner mechanics of it. It might be interesting to know it, but the relevant point is we know how it works. That you feed it a certain type of behavior, whether it's thought, speech, or action, and it seems to just demand more and more of that same thought, speech, and action.
Got it. Thank you.
Rabbi Taub?
Yeah.
Hey, Shalom Aleichem, this is Velvel. So let me ask a question. I think you were saying that the craving only takes place when a person takes an action of lust. Is it not true that even, let's say someone has euphoric recall, they have images in their minds and they sit on it and they let it happen instead of taking an action against it. Isn't that true that also can, bring about the craving? Even though he didn't take an action necessarily of doing something, cruising or whatever, but the fact that he's letting that euphoric recall build in his mind, isn't that also the act of craving?
100%. Let me clarify here. For the sexaholic, his liquor store is in his brain. Okay? So the alcoholic understands that he's going to go out somewhere to get the chemical. The sexaholic can find that chemical inside of himself. So how does he take a drink of that lust? You can do it by putting yourself in an actual physical environment where there's stimuli in front of you to look at. Or, like you mentioned, you could be sitting at the baseball game and in your brain check out and go to some place. And, that fantasizing is an active. It doesn't he let – you said something I emphatically disagree with. He let it happen. He didn't let it happen. He made a choice. It's a bad choice. It's probably the choice as the result of clouded thinking because of an obsession that's convincing him that that choice will not end in disaster like before. But he doesn't let it happen. He makes a choice. The choice is, once the thought comes knocking at the door and he says, let's see, let's play with this, let's see what we can get out of it. And, you know, it's like dancing with the 2,000-pound gorilla. The dance isn't over until the gorilla decides.
Yeah, I just want to say, for me, if I don't take an act of distraction, distracting myself by doing or thinking something else, then automatically that thing is going to build and build and build, and it's very dangerous.
Right. Right, and that is how thought works. You can't not think, but you can choose what you think about. So, in other words, let's distinguish between the regular tetzahara of man comes to him and says, let's think about your hura and yours. Let's think about dirty thoughts. That's a regular yetzahara. What's the sane response? The sane response of a sexaholic is, no, I don't think so. If I start thinking about this, I don't know how far it goes. Now, what does the regular Russia do? The regular Russia, I mean the non-sexaholic, the thought comes and he says, oh, great, it's fun. I'll do it, and I'll think about it, and I'll stop it when I need to stop it. And he has that luxury. He has that dubious luxury of lusting like a gentleman. He's got it under control. Unfortunately, that luxury is the luxury to choose to be disconnected from Hashem for that moment. And that the host doesn't have that luxury. He doesn't have the luxury of disconnecting himself from Hashem for that moment. He's got to actually be a mensch.
Rabbi, and also to remind Belville and the rest of the Hever distraction that Belva talked about really falls in line with the white knuckling suggestion you made and is not a long-term solution.
Well, it depends how it's done. Trying to remove the obsessive thought that the unrecovered addict has, yeah, that's a white knuckling technique. But let's say it's not an obsessive thought. It's just a regular yetzahara. It's, hey, let's think about sex. So the sane answer is, let's not. Why not think about cheeseburgers? We're not thinking about cheeseburgers, or we're not going to think about sex. It's just not happening. That's the sane response. That's called hesach hadas. And that's not white knuckling. That's just the sane response to the disease's request to get some playtime. If he has the sane response and says, no, we're not going to start to do it in thought, speech, and action, we're not going to choose the behavior, then he won't activate the phenomenon of craving. And since he's obsession-free as well, because he had the spiritual awakening, he should be able to be on with his day in less than a second.
Rabbi Taub, this is Rotze. This spiritual awakening that you're speaking of, which is a side effect or the desired result of having gone through the steps, again, it seems to be, at least for me, rather elusive. Hard to know that you've had or haven't had the awakening. It's hard to know, how to hold on to it. You're making it sound like it's a one-time experience, and you've had it, and now it's just a question of maintaining it. To me, it's difficult to, since I don't think it's happened for me, at least in its entirety. It's hard for me to system a little bit.
Let's talk about things that are, anestoris l'Hashem alakeinu, l'niglis lano uvaneinu. So let's talk about things that are himozachen, abstract ideas up in the heaven. Talk about very down-to-earth things that we can monitor and we can evaluate. All right, spiritual experience, I don't know what it is. I think there's as many different spiritual experiences as there are human beings on the planet. There's billions of varieties of spiritual experiences. So let's talk about what we can actually wrap our heads around. The effect of having had a spiritual experience. The effect is the psychic change. Psychic change means ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the mainstays of these men, are suddenly thrust aside and replaced by a whole new way of living. Okay, so in other words, it's brain surgery without a scalpel. The brain has changed. You've had a spiritual experience. Your way of viewing reality should have changed categorically, wholesale. Your entire outlook on life should be a different one. Whether it happened rapidly through an upheaval or it happened gradually, still gradually over time that you don't even know exactly pinpointing how or when it happened, but you know to compare yourself to now and before, your view of reality is radically different than you've had the spiritual experience.
I think it's more, for me personally, it's more of want to want, an awareness that there is a different way of looking at things, something that David Chaim speaks about, an awareness of your perceptions and motives, an awareness of how your own character flaws impact life's story around you, so that you can minimize a degree of the risk that you're faced with. But to say that there's actually a psychic change, like you're just different, that I haven't experienced it, or I don't think I have. So
that there could be an event that could be so profound that event could be a life changing event. The person would never see life the same after that event.
Okay, so if that's the case, for me, I haven't seen that kind of life event, or if I have, I have squandered the experience by going back to the old lifestyle. But be that as it may,
sex addicts that I speak to tell me that there was an event in their life, usually in childhood, that changed them forever, and since then, they just don't think like other people think. So I hear a lot that there are events that can totally change the way you see reality. Why can't we believe that the Midah Tova is Meruba than the Midah Prana?
I haven't seen it. I mean,
rarely
I don't
have
know.
We seen a person fail who has thoroughly
I'm sorry?
Followed our path. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I think the proof is in the pudding.
I think what also helps Rabbi Taub is on page 567 in the Big Book. And that's why they included in the appendix an appendix called Spiritual Experience, because they too
the
got the same
sudden. Yeah, I mean, David Chaim, of course. I mean, but that's not even the issue we're discussing here. Whether it happened rapidly all at once, like a white light experience, like you call it, or of the what's called in the appendix the educational variety, which means that it kind of crept up incrementally over a period of time. That can either here nor there. We're not even talking about did it happen fast all at once or did it happen over time. What we're talking about is the end effect. The end result is the psychic change. So if you had the spiritual experience, it means you look at life differently. You have, like Chuck C. called it, a new pair of glasses.
But that's a constant struggle to constantly be looking at life differently than your old design for living. It's not something that is like a flashlight or a light switch that's turned on and off, and then from then on you see things that way. It's where you're faced with those things that had in the past forced you or enticed you into a negative response, and you are reassessing it, reevaluating it, readdressing it in a way that is healthier, in a way that is more godly, more spiritual. But it's a
What you're describing sounds like cognitive behavioral therapy. It sounds like it's a religious way of approaching cognitive behavioral therapy, but basically it's saying, in each case, let's evaluate it and try to make better decisions. What I'm saying is that the psychic change means that your way of assessing options from the very instant they occur is a different way of looking at it. And rather than saying, choice A or choice B, okay, let's remember, let's think through the drink, let's figure out, where did this line meet before? That's a white knuckling technique.
If it is an automated response to situations that heretofore would have been triggering or would have been reason to go off the deep end, and I can't say I've had that experience.
Okay. I just want to make this very clear in one sentence. The goal is to be able to be exposed to things that may have been a trigger in the past and that they are not experienced as triggers. The definition of recovered is I see it, I know what it is, I know how it affected me in the past. But you know what? It's not that interesting to me like it used to be. It's something that I can see, I can notice, and I can just let it go and move on with life. That's the psychic change. That's the goal of recovery. There's other methods,
about how to deal with the struggle. But you know what? Recovery is not about dealing with the struggle. It's about the struggle being removed so you can actually use your great Jewish struggling skills on things that are much better than just struggling with Yisurim. When we get obsession free, we can use our struggling skills to push ourselves in higher levels of Kedusha.
Yeah, it does say in the big book, by the way, we will recoil from it as if it's a hot flame. It does say in the big book.
Rotsay, what the program also offers you, and Rabbi Taub offered it, illustrated it before, is that that's what step 10, 11, and 12 is. You know, I don't want you to be discouraged because you...
10, 11, and 12, though, apparently, from what Rabbi Taub is saying, are simply maintenance techniques that are post-experience. I'm talking about the actual experience, which by definition, correct me if I'm wrong.
Don't worry if you can pinpoint when the experience happened. The main question is, did you get the results? I don't have to know when it happened, when the change happened, or how long the change took. I need to know, did the change occur? Because the proof's in the pudding, is the obsession gone?
No.
Okay.
Just to clarify here, the change is not something that just immediately clicks. Unless somebody has, let's say somebody, I know someone who was diagnosed with cancer and they had a life-changing experience. If somebody doesn't have something like that, and it's more of just you're going through the process of a regular living and you're working through the program, not necessarily the spiritual awakening is going to happen in one day. You know, it's like Rabbi Tversky, I keep referring to this, Rabbi Tversky said, you know, years ago, and he said it when he spoke last year, that the man I was, he said that he heard this at a meeting, somebody got up and said, the man I once was will continue to drink. The man I am today will no longer drink. So essentially what we're really trying to do is change who we are, the essence, the core essence of what we used to do, and that's a process. It takes time. And
That is not what Rabbi Taub is saying. What Rabbi Taub is saying is that because of the spiritual experience, you are not the same.
Well, the spiritual experience is a process. I mean, at least for me, it's not like I can't say, "Oh, that made me." Like, it's a process. It's nothing that happened. It's taken a couple of years. And I've learned from being in the program.
Well,
but
let's
not
debate about how
that
long the process takes. Look, it's very rare that a person has a major upheaval where the psychic change occurs in an instant. Very rare. Most people experience it incrementally. It happens over time. But that's not the discussion here. The discussion is, what's the goal of working steps? The goal is that the obsession is removed because you have a different brain, a new pair of glasses.
Right, Rabbi Taub, what we want to help the gentleman, the chevra realize is that if they're not experiencing it right away, to not say, well, I've heard guys say, well, the program doesn't work. That drawing that conclusion is inaccurate, and it's also usually derails their desire or interest in continuing to work the program.
If I felt that I had not had a spiritual experience, my response would be to find a sponsor who is going to really make sure that I go through steps and pound the workout. I do it honestly and thoroughly, and that's what I would do. And I guarantee you, you will have a psychic change. Whether you're going to see Malach Mechoil floating, I mean, I don't know what your spiritual experience is going to be like, or if you'll even know when it happened, but you'll know that you had one because you think differently. You think the mind is rewired.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, that was fine.
Yes, this is fundamentally different. This is fundamentally different than what my understanding was. It's not a process by which you're working at something. It's a process by which God has rewired you. I mean, that is that is very different than I don't want to derail anyone, but it is very different than I understood it to be, in the sense that, okay, take off this pair of glasses and put on a new pair of glasses, which is an active process on the part of the person, which in and of itself is your process of recovery. Your recovery is putting on glasses, and you're not saying that.
What I'm saying is, my recovery is acknowledging that my old pair of glasses is broken and there's no sense in getting them back and fixing them. And now allowing God to give me a new pair of glasses.
By the way, if you have some baby crying in the background, it might be a good time for you to mute your phone with the star six. Yes, Ellie, you have a question.
Yeah, I feel that we are, experiencing, spiritual awakening. Just we're ignoring it because we're just insensitive to this. We're just not realizing. I think the program help us just to kind of enable us to be more sensitive, to allow God just, to feel Him more, to connect to Him more. Through addiction, we become so insensitive, so we ignore even our baby cries in the other room when we are going through, acting out process. We are so insensitive, so nothing can go through to our mind. So through the 12 steps, I just feel that we are really, changing ourselves and become more sensitive and realizing the spiritual awakeness is always was there. It's kind of, happening.
I love what you're saying, and I just want to add one thing, and then I should run, which is the greatest thing you can do to promote that sensitivity is when you share, don't talk about your struggles. We all know what the struggles are. Talk about the little ways in which your spiritual awakening have given you a different way of reacting to life. Talk about your successes. Talk about where there was stress. Not necessarily a sexual trigger, where there was stress in your life and you reacted differently because your thinking is on a new plane.
Outstanding. Rabbi Taub, thank you very much for this real Kiddush view, insightful view of the program and the process of recovery, the fine-tuned differences. They're fine, but so powerfully impactful on us. So you should be benched to continue to spread this important message to all that you touch, and you should touch many throughout the world. Yasher Koch to you, Rabbi Taub.
Thank you, Rabbi Taub.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thank you so much for the opportunity. May you all and may we all have that permanent freedom, a new way of looking at life, and that's when life really begins. We can really get started helping other people and being good to God's kids and to God.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Rabbi Taub.
Thank you.